It's Wednesday, April 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello, glad you're with us. Coming up, voters may finally be sealing U.S. presidential nominations. The slow rebuilding process gains momentum in Nepal.
Tourism there, in a sense of short-term stay, is absolutely safe.
A nuclear disaster now glows with tourists. Also ahead, SUVs are popular in China. Can an old breed of car muscle its way into the market? It's all on today's International Edition. Voters in five U.S. states, Rhode Island, Maryland, Connecticut, Delaware, and Pennsylvania, are casting their ballots in their state's presidential primaries. The results could bring a surge in momentum for frontrunners Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton as they look to seal their respective party nominations. VOA's Lori London explored what's at stake with Glenn Thrush, chief political correspondent for Politico.
Let's talk about the Democratic side first. I think Bernie Sanders is just about done. He was, I think, pretty much finished off after the New York primary, where he had stated as a goal to really get within single digits of Hillary Clinton. He lost by 16 points. It was a pretty emphatic victory. It looks like he's headed to a very big loss in Pennsylvania. I think it'll be very interesting on Wednesday morning to see where the Sanders campaign is, how they intend to go on, what their rationale is.
Does he have any path to victory at this point?
No. And he really hasn't had a path to victory since March 15th. You know, at that point in time, he would have had to have won in upwards of 60% of the remaining delegates. You know, the only conceivable way he could win would be for something very negative to happen with the emails, an indictment or something like that. No one at the moment is claiming that that is going to happen. And his core argument is that he'd be able to convince superdelegates. That's even more of a fairy tale. Bernie Sanders has alienated so much of the Democratic Party. In fact, I did an interview with Hillary Clinton a couple of weeks ago where she questioned whether or not he was even a Democrat. I think his chances of winning are very small, but the thing that keeps him going, money. Win or lose, on Wednesday morning, he's going to raise a couple million dollars online.
I hear there's also trouble in the Trump campaign with his new campaign manager's ability to rein him in, so to speak, to be more presidential.
I had an interview with Roger Stone, who's another senior Trump advisor, the one who put Paul Manafort, the kind of current head of the pack there in the Trump camp, in place. And, you know, Stone basically described, the direct quote that Stone gave me was, "You don't manage Donald Trump." And I think we're seeing that day after day after day. Mm-hmm. Trump is just a really difficult guy to tell what to do. And success has made him oblivious to this sort of advice. He knows from the polls that he stands a very significant chance of getting wiped out in a one-to-one matchup against Hillary Clinton.
Will he get the delegates?
On Tuesday, he is poised to get hundreds more delegates. We are seeing this bizarre tentative alliance between John Kasich and Ted Cruz falling apart before it even began. So I think what we are going to see is a serious solidification of Hillary versus Donald as the ultimate storyline in the fall.
We're also starting to hear more about candidates vetting potential running mates. What are you hearing on both sides?
I think a lot of that is overstated. You know, there were some reports recently that Ted Cruz is vetting Carly Fiorina. I don't know how you vet somebody when you're as far behind in delegates as Ted Cruz is. I've heard reports Fiorina was floating that more than Ted Cruz was. You know, on the Democratic side, we kind of know, in general, who the cast of characters would be. There would be a lot of pressure to pick a Latino. What I've been hearing month after month after month, and I've covered the Clintons for 15 years, is that if they had their preference, it would be Tim Kaine, the senator from Virginia and former Democrat National Committee chairman. They believe he would be most fit to serve as president in the event that she couldn't. And he's a party-building guy. And that's what the Democrats, and with the Clintons in particular, want to accomplish in the election, and that is to sort of rebuild the Democratic Party into a national force at a time when the Republican Party seems to be disintegrating.
A new poll out by NBC News and SurveyMonkey is out and says that for the first time, Donald Trump has reached 50% support nationally from Republican or Republican-leaning voters. Trump's challengers, Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Ohio Governor John Kasich, lost ground in that survey, finishing double digits behind him. Trump came into Tuesday with 845 delegates. He needs about 400 more to win a first ballot nomination at the Republican convention in July. Otherwise, Cruz and Kasich could have a shot at the nomination. In the Democratic race, Hillary Clinton entered the day with 1,944 delegates. She needs to win just over half of the remaining available delegates to reach her needed majority of 2,383. Well, we turn now to our social media segment and the one and only International Edition's G. Abby Lee, who joins me in the studio with what's buzzing online. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
Well, it's Super Tuesday again.
It is.
Let me guess, what's the trending hashtag?
Hashtag Super Tuesday is still trending, but the more popular hashtag is hashtag Election 2016. Five northeastern states are set to vote Tuesday in Republican and Democratic primaries, as you mentioned. And we talked about it briefly yesterday, but we do have a lot of friends in Maryland who are casting their ballots today. But in addition to Maryland, people in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, and Delaware are also voting. Polls in all five states close at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And there's also another hashtag that will generate a graphic for you on Twitter.
Oh, and what's that?
It's hashtag IVoted, which will generate a box with a check mark in your tweet. And Democratic contender Bernie Sanders is encouraging his Twitter followers to use that hashtag. That's because high voter turnout is important for the Vermont senator. His supporters claim there is a voter suppression in place against them by the Democrat establishment. His rival, Hillary Clinton, is focusing on targeting Hispanic voters by tweeting in Spanish. Her account also shared clips of her recent town hall meeting, during which she answered questions about gun violence and gender equality.
Well, on the GOP side, we covered it this time yesterday, the alliance between Ted Cruz and John Kasich. Mm-hmm. What else is trending?
Donald Trump shared five different clips encouraging voters to cast their ballots, and the roughly 20-second-long videos all feature, you guessed it, his daughter, Ivanka Trump. Ted Cruz and John Kasich are also encouraging their voters to get out and vote, but their Twitter feeds lack the type of multimedia aspects that are so important in engaging people. Back to you, Jim.
Well, thanks for the great wrap-up, G. She tweets for our program's account at VOA_IE, also from her own account at G. Abby Lee, and I'm there at VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Nepal's prime minister has announced the start of reconstruction of key heritage sites damaged by a massive earthquake just over a year ago that left around 9,000 dead. Prime Minister Kaja Prasad Oli offered prayers Monday at an ancient Buddhist temple. That's one of hundreds of historic structures damaged by the 7.8 magnitude quake that struck on April 25, 2015. Meanwhile, the New York-based World Monuments Fund on Monday announced grants totaling $1 million for five historic sites. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies estimates 4 million people still live in substandard temporary shelters. Mike Bruce is a spokesman for the non-governmental organization Plan International. Speaking from Kathmandu via Skype, he tells VOA's Victor Beatty the government hasn't been slow in rebuilding, but has faced challenges in the past year.
I don't think they've been dragging their feet. They faced enormous challenges over the last year. The trade blockade from India, the constitutional protests, and just the realities of an emergency response this scale in a terrain like this. But nonetheless, we would like to see things proceeding faster. 1 year is too long for children to still be going to school in temporary structures, and it's too long for people to still be living in temporary shelters.
There's been over $4 billion of donors have pledged to the reconstruction effort, but there's still funds that are unspent.
Of that $4 billion, only about $2.2 billion have actually been received in Nepal. And that's the second part of the problem. Even if the government says, go, yes, commence reconstruction everywhere immediately, the money just isn't there. And we do need a lot more international support to really rebuild Nepal and to really transition to a recovery.
There are reports that there has been some unrest over a new constitution adopted last September. Has that been part of the problem?
It was part of the problem. Those protests that took place resulted in the trade blockage with India, and that resulted in a nationwide fuel crisis that really hampered operations and really forced organizations like Plan International to prioritize those most in need and to make really tough decisions about moving forward.
Aside from, of course, the appalling living conditions of so many of the Nepalese people, you still have reconstruction that is needed for damaged centuries-old temples and royal palaces in the Kathmandu Valley.
I walked around Kathmandu a bit yesterday, and it's really sad to see. It's really sad to look back on the Kathmandu I saw a few years ago, and even those structures that haven't been substantially damaged are propped up with crutches everywhere you go. They're sort of leaning off to one side, and there's a huge fear that even a moderate aftershock could really do tremendous new damage.
So is it your view that we've turned a corner on the reconstruction?
Certainly, absolutely very hopeful that we have. Again, our operations at no point have stopped, and we've continued to deliver urgent and relief aid. With the government's announcement yesterday that yes, reconstruction can start and can start widely, we are very much hoping that we're able to start building the schools that we plan to build, that we're able to start training the masons in safe earthquake techniques, and that we are able to really, really start rebuilding this wonderful country.
Plan International's Mike Bruce said over 30,000 classrooms were damaged or destroyed, and his NGO plans to rebuild more than half so they're both accessible to the injured and better able to withstand future natural disasters. It's been 30 years since the Chernobyl nuclear disaster that threatened much of Europe with a radioactive cloud. The site in Ukraine has now become a popular tourism attraction, especially for foreigners. VOA's Oksana Lihotsova and Ruslan Denichenko visited the Chernobyl exclusion zone recently to find out why people wanted to visit the site. Molly McKitterick narrates their report.
Among the foreign tourists are Americans, Austrians, Czechs, and Swedes. Their reasons for visiting vary.
Just curiosity.
Danny Roberts says his sick brother wanted a picture of the site.
He knows more about Chernobyl than anyone, so for that reason I came today.
Belgian engineer François Duayen came to see the huge structure being built to cover the destroyed reactor.
I know that there are like a lot of French companies that work here, and I was curious to know how it was done.
Accompanied by the squeaking of dosimeter devices to measure radiation and the chirping of birds, the tourists roam through abandoned houses. In the midst of overgrown thickets, there's a storehouse, a country club, a kindergarten. In the Chernobyl exclusion zone, equal in size to Luxembourg, many surprises are hiding. A huge structure was once a top-secret military radar facility that could detect the launch of a missile on the other side of the Earth. Westerners called it the Russian woodpecker because of the specific sound it made over the airwaves. Tourists ride a bus to see the ghost city of Pripyat. Its residents were driven away on the third day following the accident and told the city would be washed and cleaned, and they would be brought right back. They were told to take nothing with them.
With foreigners, you must explain the bigger picture against the background of what was happening. A foreigner needs to understand why it happened, why people who lived in the Soviet Union thought one way and not otherwise.
One of the first travel companies that brought tourists was Chernobyl Tour. Its founder used to work at the site after the accident.
Radiation levels have fallen in such quantities since that time that tourism there, in a sense of short-term stay, is absolutely safe. Compared to what I personally measured there, levels decreased 1,000 times, which is a great success in overcoming the consequences of the accident.
Thousands of tourists visit Chernobyl every year, and the number is growing. Forbes magazine called it the most exotic place for tourism on Earth. Those who have visited agree that it is special, the only place on the entire planet where Judgment Day has already taken place. For Oksana Lihustova, Ruslan Danychenko of VOA's Ukrainian service, I'm Molly McKitterick.
And if you're interested in seeing that site, all you have to do is go to our website, and the video is right there at voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
Beijing's largest annual car show is in progress right now. The fastest-growing segment in China's car market is on the low end of the spectrum, with compact and mid-size models made by domestic brands making up the bulk of the sport utility vehicle sales there. SUVs are being marketed as a popular option for China's rough rural roads and are the only product segment that's still growing in the world's largest market. Last year, SUVs accounted for 1/3 of all vehicle sales in China, and industry analysts say that figure could rise to half. Industry insiders point to a push by major Chinese cities to curb congestion and smog by limiting new car ownership, and that is also helping to drive the SUV boom. Meanwhile, China overtook the United States last year as the biggest electric car market by number of vehicles sold. Muscle cars were very popular 50 years ago among U.S. drivers, and now, as VOA Steve Miller reports, Ford Motor is marketing their four-cylinder model in China.
Throughout the 1950s and 60s, muscle cars enjoyed enormous popularity, allowing the average person the opportunity to purchase some speed. Now, these were American two-door cars with big, powerful V8 engines. Think the Pontiac GTO, the Chevy Camaro, the Dodge Challenger, and the Ford Mustang. But with the oil crisis in the 1970s, these gas-guzzling beasts fell out of favor. While muscle cars haven't gone the way of the dodo, they have been forced to adapt to the modern era, meaning that while some might like to put the pedal to the metal, open things up and unleash a throaty, rumbling V8 engine on the highway, in other parts of the world, drivers have a different need. Eric Merkel is a sales analyst at the Ford Motor Company, and he says that that factored into how the iconic Ford Mustang was marketed in China, where power wasn't the primary draw.
You spend a lot of time in traffic. So, you know, to really get the full exhilaration of a 5-liter V8, it's kind of hard to do. Mustang, for them, it's an American icon. It's more of a status symbol. They like to be seen in their cars.
The experience factor isn't just something those abroad are seeking either. Scott Evans, associate editor at Motor Trend.
These days, a lot of the original muscle cars are becoming desirable because they're little pieces of nostalgia, the little pieces of our past. When our parents had these muscle cars, you know, we remember riding around in them as kids.
So in a country like China, manufacturers face the challenge of providing a muscle car experience inside a package that's better suited to its driving environment. That usually means moving away from a large V8 to a smaller engine, a process that creates its own set of challenges.
There's a few issues in that we had to overcome.
That's Tom Barnes, vehicle engineer manager for the Ford Mustang.
The first one is we had to make sure it accelerated well. And what that meant is some of the EcoBoost engines that we had in the world, like we have a 1 liter, that didn't put out enough. We didn't have enough. So we had to kind of go for the biggest I-4 we could.
Without getting too technical, Barnes says they were able to cram a whole lot of power into a small four-cylinder engine. But there was one lingering problem they still needed to address.
It needed to have some sound of some sort. And people know, even if you don't think you know, a V8 sounds pretty cool. And I will tell you, an I-4 doesn't have that ability. But what we do is we use something called electronic sound enhancement, which is playing sounds of the engine through the speakers.
And while that might not exactly be the same as a throaty V8, Barnes says it does provide a good customer experience. So what's the future of muscle cars? Scott Evans doesn't think they're going away anytime soon, but with the rise of electric vehicles and demand for increased fuel efficiency.
Decades in the future, I think things like muscle cars, things like V8 engines are going to eventually become luxury items.
Steve Miller, VOA News, Washington.
To buckle up and take a little ride out, but we'll come back, and we hope you do too. You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website, voanews.com, and on Twitter at @VOA_IE. For Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Daryl Smith, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a super day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
According to the 2015 country reports on human rights practices issued by the State Department in mid-April, Russia's authoritarian government continues to commit and ignore numerous human rights violations. First, citizens' right to choose their leadership in free and fair elections was consistently restricted through the government's efforts to suppress dissent. New and existing repressive laws were used to harass, discredit, and punish individuals and organizations that criticized the government. The government particularly targeted those who spoke up in support of the government of Ukraine or opposed the Russian government's activities in Ukraine. Further, the Russian government continued to selectively prosecute racial, ethnic, religious, and sexual minorities and migrant workers. In addition, officials denied due process to defendants in politically motivated cases. The government used secret detentions and convictions based on questionable treason and espionage charges, and even tried and convicted non-Russian citizens taken illegally from other countries, especially Ukraine. Yet at the same time, authorities failed to bring to justice individuals responsible for the deaths of prominent journalists, activists, whistleblowers, and opposition politicians. Indeed, Russia's support of separatists in eastern Ukraine and its two-year occupation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula were responsible for some of the worst human rights abuses in the region. According to international monitors and human rights NGOs, the combined Russian separatist forces in the Donbas region and the Russian occupation authorities in Crimea caused thousands of civilian deaths and injuries. Russian occupation authorities in Crimea cracked down on members of certain groups, in particular Ukrainians and Crimean Tatars, who spoke out in opposition to the occupation. And finally, conflict in northern Caucasus between government forces, insurgents, Islamist militants, and criminal forces led to numerous human rights abuses and a general degradation in the rule of law. Such abuses imperil the future of Russia and its people. In the words of Secretary of State John Kerry, a government that fails to respect human rights, no matter how lofty its pretensions, has very little to boast about, to teach, and very little indeed in the way of reaching its full potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.